So this is the second day of the April retreat. We had one retreat here where we began the retreat and came out and we had a different president. So you never know what happens if you sit strongly. We know already that retreat practice is like the weather. It's cloudy, and then sun comes through, and we're astonished, grateful. The clouds come back again, a bit of rain and lightning, mist, a lot of mist. Suddenly the sky clears again, grateful. Down we go, clouds come. And this pattern, or just seeing the pattern in itself, already tells us something. Then we try and figure out what it is that it's telling us. And then the clouds really come in. That's our life. That's cushion life. So let's go back a moment to the story from yesterday. I bring a whole lot of books here, and the one I meant to read from is not here. Bucliffe. No, thank you. It's fine, I'll read this instead. This is the one from yesterday. But as you gather, there are a few of these kind of collections, and they have overlapping stories, and sometimes they have slightly different translations. And suddenly one translation kind of speaks to me, and the other gets the clouds. Anyway, let's go with this one for now. All right. Beijing's Gate of Essential Nature from the True Dharma Eye. During a work period at his monastery, Beijing Huihai was ploughing the ground. A monastic heard the sound of the drum ending the work period. That moment he held up his hoe, burst into laughter, and went back to the monastery. That's the core of that story. And then it goes on. Beijing says, these are teacher's words, "Wonderful, this is Avalokiteshvara, the figure of compassion, entering the gate of essential nature." Then after Beijing returned to the monastery, sent for the monk, asked, "What did you see to make you laugh like that?" The monastic said, "I was hungry. As soon as I heard the drum, I returned to have the noon meal." And Beijing laughed. So the story's in kind of two parts like that. There's the original moment, and then there's the teacher's sort of wise words, saying it's essential nature, or Buddha nature, or enlightenment, or seen it, or whatever the phrase is. And then he calls the monk in and presumably wants to see if the monk has complicated anything yet. The monk seems to keep a clear mind, and the teacher's satisfied. Off they go. But the core of that the whole teaching of that is about that original moment of the drum sounding at the end of the work period, and the monk holding up his hoe and laughing. He obviously was very hungry. But just very happy. And the moment we start talking about, the moment we start putting enlightenment or Buddha nature or essential nature or testing the monk or seeing is he this or is it that or is it true or is it genuine, the whole story gets kind of complicated again. And that's what we do in our practice. And that's what a lot of, quote, spiritual, unquote, teachings are. That they take something and stab it. Whack. Somehow trying to make a system out of it, or trying to find words that will connect us to that. Somehow trying to make a system, trying to make a diagram. Some sense of taking something very pure and innocent and trying to own it, if you like, trying to possess it, trying to make it ours. But in its very nature, we will only harm it by its very nature. It has wings. And somehow in our practice, our work here is to take these moments when they come, allow them to go when they go, and simply let it be like that. That's our practice, isn't to find a way to enlightenment or to kind of bludgeon our way to enlightenment, whatever enlightenment means, of course, that's another thing, towards some experience or some idealized non-illusory state or non-dual state, whatever words we use for it. Our practice is not to kind of, I struggle to find the words for it, but complicate or possess or stick. What happens is that when moments come of clarity and openness, we instinctively recognize them. We know them to be true in a particular way. And excuse my words, I'm just trying to point somewhere. We know them, we recognize them. There's a purity, an unassailability about those moments. And we all have them. We've had them before we come here, we've had them while we're here. And it's somehow to allow the innocence of that clarity to just speak for itself and let it be. It's really difficult to do that because we want so much for it to be ours. Okay. We really want it very much. So we'll try and analyze it, and we'll intellectualize it. We'll make a system. We'll try and trick it, bluff it, bludgeon it. It never works. It just simply doesn't work. But we don't learn from that. We always think a system needs refining. Oh, if I think of it this way, that way, bum, bum, off we go. We spend a week strategizing here. And then we drive home and we look into the face of the young man filling our car, and suddenly, boom. There it is, all the time. And the only way you can honor that moment is to smile back and pay your bill. 365 rand 70. Okay. It's complete love. One thing that we also do often is we kind of lose confidence in ourselves as angels. We read stories about monks raising their hose and laughing and thinking, okay, if I practice for 20 years and hoe the lands every day, I can also do that. It just means we've got stuck in that story. Already we've sort of sucked it dry. Like an incubus. Okay. And these kind of moments are all around. You know yourselves. You're having a cloudy sit and the bell rings. Oh, just breathe out with gratitude. Okay, and suddenly you're sitting. Boom. Okay. Great timekeeper. So kind. Okay. So one of the ways we work with sort of in interviews or koan style things is we look at the story of the man hoeing the field, and then we are compelled to say, but you're not in the field now. How will you find that quality of that moment? Here. You, while you're listening to this talk. While you're watching me wave my arms around, me talking, searching for words. The moments are here. Sometimes we see them, sometimes we don't. This is our practice, the finding and the losing, the finding and the losing. If we accept both the finding and the losing, then finding and losing change their meaning. Something else happens. Some fullness begins to creep in. And it's not our doing. It's not because of anything I have done. It's not because of anything I have been able to achieve or succeed at. It's almost that when that kind of me has evaporated for a moment or just lain down to rest, that there it is. All the time it was there. We were looking so hard, we couldn't see it. the coughing next door. Wonderful, wonderful. So everyone's heart goes out to her. Just like when and that one. The koan collections are full of stories of people just trying very hard and suddenly seeing something that's in front of them all the time. I'm reminded of an arbitration I did recently. Oh, before I start there, just not getting stuck on a sort of monastic model of what these moments are. They come everywhere, and that's how our life is. It's full from edge to edge. And recently I was doing a very bad-tempered arbitration in Kimberley. And arbitration is a kind of a legal process where you sit at the top and you listen to witnesses. It's just slightly less formal than court proceeding. And arbitrators don't get lifelong pensions when they retire. But it was a very sort of highly charged dispute set in a remote mine in the Northern Cape where one of the new unions was trying to take over the mine. The old union was resisting, and there was all of that kind of thing going off. So you got the militant union, the old union, and then the owners, and everything's very emotional, and nobody's speaking to everybody. What had happened was that a whole lot of new union members had refused to work because of some dispute. They'd all been dismissed, and then they were accused of going on the rampage, and they sort of trashed this hostel and assaulted people and beat them up and chased them out and so on. The police came, and there was security and all sorts of things happened. Very highly sort of emotionally charged. So the union members of the new union members were then dismissed for the attack, intimidation and assault and so on and so forth. And I was called in to arbitrate this dispute. The union said it was unfair. The union said it was the owner who got his security to trash his own hostel in order to discredit the union, and so on and so forth. And of course, the mine owners said it was the union. One of the features of it is that the mine couldn't find any witnesses willing to testify because they were frightened. These are men who live in a very isolated community that had sort of basically been taken over by the new union. And so the few white mine owners came and testified to what they saw, a few security people, but they couldn't get any mine workers to testify. Eventually they found one man, and they brought him. And he came in these sort of tattered PPE, they call it, personal protective equipment, clothing, the overalls with reflective stripes, and just sort of all torn and dirty and unkempt. Couldn't speak English or Afrikaans. And he was now the witness for the mine against the union. And saw him in, and he told his story about how these people chased him out and assaulted him and beat him and broke his door and chased his friends and so on and so forth. But very halting and kind of uncomfortable, this poor man out of his comfort zone completely. So, and I could see the attorney for the union licking his lips. And this is the only witness against us, and this guy I will make mincemeat of. And I was getting quite nervous, of course everyone's getting a bit edgy. And then cross-examination started with the mine lawyer then now trying to discredit this witness. And he tried to make this man a liar. He tried to make him a lackey of the owners. He tried to tell him it was dark and he couldn't see at night and he couldn't identify people. And, the more he was really quite belligerent, the lawyer, and the more he attacked this man, the more this man just sat back and kept to his story. And there was this astonishing match between this very aggressive, rather increasingly desperate lawyer and this completely unsophisticated general work. I think he was a cleaner and level 14 in some way, who was absolutely clear and firm and fearless. And it was an astonishing kind of transformation to witness this person who came in was apologetic and uncomfortable and inarticulate. And when it needed to be, he was absolutely clear. Absolutely clear. And it was just such a lesson, I think, for everybody there. Excuse me. I need a drink of water. It was just such a lesson in integrity and fearlessness from this unsophisticated person, who swore he never belonged to a union in his life. He said something about, "I'm my own republic. I'm never going to belong to any union, ever, till I die. So I don't care if they kill me. But I'm not going to change." Anyway, so on and so forth. But there was an astonishing kind of sense of everybody in that room that something remarkable had happened. And we couldn't sort of put our fingers on it. And yet it changed us some way. So I'm telling that just because it was such an unexpected event. You know. We never know where we're going to find this life appearing in all its radiance. And maybe the fact that it's unexpected makes it all the more likely. So we practice not knowing what we're doing in a very fundamental way. We practice saying, "I don't know, but I'm going to keep trying I'm going to do my best. I'm going to give this everything I've got. It's all I can do. And sometimes we're lost in the cloud, sometimes sky appears. We can't manipulate it, we can't plan it, we can't design it, we can't argue it. We can only recognize those moments of unassailable and undeniable radiance when they appear. And so, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Just sit quietly for a minute or two, if you don't mind.